Of course, ready to hear argument in Yoder versus Delmarva Power and Light. Are you ready to proceed? Very well, Mr. Fletcher.
Good morning, Justice Holland. May it please the court, William Fletcher on behalf of the Yoder appellants. This appeal involves an electrocution that occurred on November 7th of 1999 involving the Noah Yoder. The appeal involves two major rulings by the lower court. The first major ruling was in late December of 2003 when the lower court ruled that as to choice of law issues for this claim, Maryland law would apply as to contributory negligence and Delaware law would apply as to damages. The Yoders have appealed that ruling as it relates to the choice of law regarding contributory negligence. There has been no appeal by any party as to the lower court's decision that the law of damages should be applied as Delaware law sets forth. The other issue, and
For clarity, Maryland has a cap. Is that what the issue is on the Delaware-Maryland choice?
No, Your Honor. Indeed, Maryland does have a cap, and the lower court ruling held that it would not enforce that cap, but rather would allow the plaintiff to make a full recovery of his damages. However, having made that ruling, the court also ruled that Maryland's contributory negligence doctrine would apply rather than Delaware's comparative doctrine. And therefore, while the statutory cap wasn't imposed on the plaintiff, an absolute cap in the form of a bar of any recovery, if the plaintiff was at any way at fault for the accident, was imposed on the plaintiffs. And it is that issue that the plaintiffs are appealing.
Well, I don't want to oversimplify or overstate the party's position on this first issue. But it seems that the general rule would be to apply the law of the state where the accident occurred. But in this case, you seem to be focusing on the public policy that Delaware has in favor of comparative negligence rather than contributory negligence as the overriding policy and why we should apply Delaware law. Is that the general idea? I realize under Travelers there are a lot of considerations, and you've talked about them in their brief, but it does appear that it comes down to that focus.
That is a focus, Your Honor, and I think it is flushed out, though, when you look at the pertinent sections of Section 6 of the Restatement of Conflicts of Laws. And there are at least three of those sections, Your Honor, that we think are very important in this case. And they are the relevant policies of the forum, Delaware, the relevant policies of the other state, which would be Maryland, and the basic policies underlining the particular field of law. And obviously the Delaware policy is well defined since the legislature has enacted a comparative negligence statute, which provides that all contributory negligence will not constitute an absolute bar. I'm sorry, all actions involving contributory negligence do not constitute an absolute bar, but rather the plaintiff's negligence will be compared to the defendant's, and as long as it's not greater, there is an appropriate recovery. And that policy, while set forth by the legislature, is a very important policy because it recognizes the concept that every person should be held accountable for their actions. And unfortunately, under the old common law contributory negligence doctrine, wrongdoers are allowed to escape responsibility. In Laws versus Webb, there's a footnote that this court identified indicating that under the old doctrine, a person could be 99% at fault, and as long as the plaintiff or as long as the person against whom the doctrine is applying was 1% at fault, then the wrongdoer, 99%, walks away scot-free. or has no liability.
Do you know how many states still have contributory negligence?
Your Honor, according to the information I got from a treatise, four remaining states. 46 of the states of our country have rejected contributory negligence and have some form of comparative negligence. Also, some of the possessions of the United States have comparative negligence. The federal government, in most of its dealings, has from decades used comparative negligence. Even England, where the concept apparently originally was derived in the early 1800s, it uses comparative negligence. Contributory negligence is basically a vestige of legal history, which unfortunately is still allowed in four states, and Maryland is one of them.
One thing that is kind of in the background of this case I'd like you to address is if the Yoders, if the utility company had been a Maryland company, the Yoders wouldn't have this argument. And it seems somewhat fortuitous that they have a claim against a Delaware company and Delaware has comparative negligence. Is that something that we should be concerned about in any way?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so, and here's why. Yes, if the argument or if the facts were that you were dealing with a Maryland power company that was incorporated in Maryland, that had its principal place in Maryland, and the accident happened in Maryland, that case would have to be brought in the state of Maryland. There's no option. There's no other recourse. But the fact is, in this case, DP&L is not only incorporated in Delaware, but its principal place of business is here. Most of its activities are in Delaware. And by being in Delaware, they know, and from the time that they've been here, that they are a subject to lawsuit in Delaware by persons that they may harm anywhere in the world. They can come to Delaware to get relief. And DP&L has known that, has recognized it, and has accepted it, and has made no changes or attempts to move or isolate itself because Delaware has joined the legion of states that follow comparative negligence. So that's why one of the first factors that the restatement talks about is the relevant policies of the forum. How do you get to the court that you're seeking relief from? There must be a connection between one or both parties and that court, or you're not in that forum. So we are in the Delaware forum, and it's because, primarily because DP&L has chosen this location for its home. The relevant policy as far as Maryland is concerned, notwithstanding the fact that it is only one of four states, is nothing more than the ongoing common law doctrine. Maryland, true, did have an opportunity to judicially abrogate the common law doctrine, and it chose not to. But there has been no affirmative action by the Maryland legislature indicating that it chooses contributory negligence, no resolutions stating that this is what the law of Maryland should be. The Maryland legislature has simply been silent, and they have not taken any action one way or the other. And then when you consider the two states, there are significant contacts by the plaintiffs in Delaware.
And in places where states have shifted from contributory negligence to comparative, has it always been done by statute, or has sometimes it happened by court?
Sometimes it happens by court, Your Honor. In fact, in the Maryland case, Harrison, which was decided back in 1986, the court noted that they were aware of at least eight states that judicially abrogated the common law doctrine of contributory negligence.
But Maryland courts have chosen not to do that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that, the last time that I can tell that they were asked to consider the matter was in 1986, and the matter hasn't arisen since then. And then Section E that talks about the basic policy underlying this field of law, I think I've mentioned a moment ago, but it is clear all of the legal writers almost unanimously indicate that the rule of comparative negligence is fair and just, and that contributory negligence is unfair, is harsh, is inflexible, and allows parties to not be responsible for their conduct. And so there's little to recommend it.
Ask you a question. Let's assume your position prevails in this appeal. And you've pointed out that some of our contiguous states have comparative negligence, but not all comparative negligence statutes work the same way. What would your position be if the accident occurred in another comparative negligence state? Would the law of that state apply because that's where the accident occurred, and their comparative negligence statute would operate that way? Or would the Delaware law apply? So, for example, you know that in Delaware, you can't be more than 50% negligent yourself. Other states have comparative negligence that's simply pro rata, even if your negligence is greater than 50%. So how would that work if you have Delaware as a comparative negligence state and DP&L allegedly causing an injury in another comparative negligence state?
Your Honor, I think it would I think you would have the same analysis, but you'd have to look at the parties, you'd have to look at where the accident happened, and what the relationship of the parties is to, I'm just going to say, Jurisdiction A. Jurisdiction A has, if I understand your question, has a more favorable comparative negligence statute than Delaware.
Or less. Different.
Or less.
Different is my point.
If the parties come to Delaware because Delaware is a jurisdictional forum for them to have their disputes resolved, then the plaintiff should know that there is going to be a significant favoring of what Delaware law is, unless the plaintiff can show that the plaintiff comes from Jurisdiction A, the defendant comes from Jurisdiction A, the accident happened in Jurisdiction A. It would have to be a significant, though tied to quality, but significant factors for Delaware to go and use Jurisdiction A's law on comparative negligence. And from a realistic standpoint, Your Honor, if you had a party from Jurisdiction A and you had the defendant from that same jurisdiction, it's likely they would just go to that forum.
I agree. But, I mean, I'm assuming the same facts of our case, except Maryland would have a different comparative negligence statute. I realize you talk about the Yoders going to church in Delaware and their other contacts with Delaware. So I realize your argument is not completely dependent on the public policy argument. But we have to figure out how we're going to apply this in the future. And there could be accidents involving DP&L and someone else in a comparative negligence state. And we have to think about how we'll apply our holding in this case if you prevail.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that if you had two states with so to speak, competing comparative negligence statutes, then Factor E, which talks about the basic policies underlying the rule, may be less important because at least the plaintiff is going to get the benefit of some type of comparative negligence. And the difference between the two may not be, well, certainly I would not expect it to be as significant as comparing contributory negligence and any form of comparative negligence. And so E may not be as important, and other considerations as to where the injury occurred or where the conduct occurred and whether or not there was a relationship between the parties, where that state, if any, is located.
Well, you don't have much time. Yeah. Do you want to move to your argument about even if Maryland law applies, why summary judgment was improper?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. As to DP&L, Your Honor, there were the record was clear from the owner and even the neighbor that they did not know that this wire was uninsulated. They did not know that it carried phase to phase at 24,000 volts. The neighbor said the wire was barely visible and it just blended in. And this is the gentleman that lives across the street. Mr. Yoder did not know about the wire. And the other wires, according to DP&L's own people, the other wires in that area were either insulate it by covering, or they did not hold a threat of injury, as this uninsulated high-voltage wire did. And so under all of those facts, when you look at what he knew or could have known, and then besides the eyewitnesses, we had a human factors expert explain, given the location of the wire, given what he was trying to do, given the lighting and the sighting and shadows, it was very reasonable for him not to appreciate how close he was to the wire. And this wire was behind him. It was above him and behind him. It was not a wire that he was working towards, working around, or trying to just miss as he was applying the sealant. That wire was not over the roof. Many of the cases that the defense cites, you have a wire that the person intentionally, knowingly walks into. And we would rely on, as to DP&L, Your Honor, we rely primarily on the Filippo case, one of the more recent cases by the Maryland Court of Appeals, which held that when a person knew that there were wires in the area and he climbed a tree and he had made contact with the wire while in the tree, that was not contributory negligence as a matter of law. The jury in that case awarded the plaintiff a recovery, and the Maryland Court of Appeals affirmed that. As to our claims against Long Arm, we believe that the lower court's fundamental error was in its analysis and use of the concept of misuse. In dealing with strict liability, the only real defense is the defense of misuse. Contributory negligence doesn't even apply. And the analysis of misuse was erroneously applied by the lower court, in particular when it noted that there was a warning. Its whole basis for misuse is that the pole had a warning. And there are pictures of this pole, portions of it, in the appendix, and you will see that the warning is buried among a mixture of different information and different types. This is the smallest type on the pole. It has 33 characters in 1 inch. That's how small the type is. Warning, and the warning says nothing about electrocution itself. But the lower court used that warning and said, well, if you don't follow that warning, then you have misused the pole. And the key Maryland Court of Appeals case is the Ellsworth case involving the wearing of a nightgown. And the nightgown had a warning on it that stated that you must stay away from any open flame or open fire. And the lady wearing the nightgown was in her own kitchen. She got too close to her range. There was a burner on, and the nightgown caught fire. And the Maryland Court of Appeals said, as a matter of law, while that may be careless, that is not a misuse. And if that type of warning is not a misuse when she goes next to a burner in her nightgown, surely the type of little warning that was on that pole is of the same nature, and at a minimum, it would be a jury issue to decide, was there a misuse in light of that warning, which we contend is inadequate and vague in nature.
We only have a minute and a half left of the time you reserved. Do you want to save that time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Price.
Good morning, Your Honor. Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, may it please the Court, I'm Summers Price here on behalf of Appalee Delmarva Power and Light Company. Edwards and I have divided our time up. I will be speaking to the choice of law issue and the Delmarva summary judgment. Mr. Edwards will talk about the Mr. Long Arm, if that's acceptable to the Court. I want to talk initially about policy because the Court appeared to have some interest in that issue. And I would commend the Harrison case to the Court in terms of the Maryland Court's very strong feelings with regard to how the contributory negligence does apply in the state of Maryland. If you read the decision, first of all, as correctly pointed out by Mr. Fletcher, the Court declined to adopt judicially any type of comparative negligence or other standard. Equally important, they gave their view that if this was an issue that was going to be handled from a policy standpoint in the state of Maryland, that it should go to the Maryland General Assembly, where they could make the decision as to what would apply. Your Honors, correctly pointed out in some of the many, many factors that one of the things we need to look at here is the concept of what the connection is with this incident. And in particular, our motion in the court below was limited to the damage issue and to the contributory negligence issue. And if you look at the conflict of laws restatement, in particular Section 164, which President Judge Vaughn cited in his opinion, that is the section on contributory negligence, and there's a specific reference in the restatement section itself and in its comments that, again, the court is to look at the law of the jurisdiction where the accident took place, the local law. It's a reaffirmation of Section 146, but specifically applies in this particular area. Now, let's look at the facts that I think are particularly significant. Obviously, the court pointed out that the Yoders both lived in Maryland at the time of this accident, but this was a Maryland resident who contracted with another Maryland resident to do work on the roof of the house. This was an individual who was licensed by the state of Maryland who was tested. Maryland, very significantly, has powerfully entered this particular arena with its high voltage law, which requires extremely active measures on the part of the individual who is going to come and work anywhere near the any type of wire. And those wires are presumed, as a matter of law, by statutory policy declaration to be over 750 volts, in other words, a high voltage wire. That was a clear, very specific declaration by the Maryland General Assembly with regard to conduct of the individual. That does not violate Delaware public policy because not long after this accident, the Delaware legislature enacted similar legislation, which is at 26 Delaware Code, Section 7401 to 7408, which is cited in our brief and reference there.
Well, one way to look at Mr. Fletcher's argument is to say that as a Delaware corporation with your principal place of business in Delaware, Delaware's public policy in favor of comparative negligence is so strong that comparative negligence follows DP&L when it goes into another state. And as I understand your argument, the default position, so to speak, from is that you apply the law of the state where the accident occurred. So putting aside the fact that Maryland has a strong public policy in favor of contributory negligence, what's your response to his argument that Delaware's comparative negligence seems to follow your client wherever they go?
Delaware has rejected, this court did not actually have a chance to deal with it, but for example, in one of the cases that I cited in the brief, the McBride versus Whiting-Turner case, there was a similar type of result. In there, Maryland has a different workman's comp law that not only applies to the direct employer, but also to subcontractor, general contractors who are not in that relationship. And in a very similar type of facts, in that case, they applied the Maryland law because of the policy determinations that they looked at the Maryland statute, they looked at all the many factors that we were talking about here, where it's, I think Your Honor may have pointed it out correctly, and although this term hasn't been used in any cases I've seen, it's been used in the reverse in the sense to reject, and maybe that does apply here, that it was pure fortuity that Mr. Yoder happened to have contact with a Delaware corporation's facilities that happened to be in Maryland. But let's not forget, Your Honor, that Delmarva is extremely heavily regulated by the state of Maryland. And if they had chosen, and that's an additional point I wanted to bring out, and they raised some arguments in their reply brief, which were not in the record below, and I do want to make sure that the court does not rely on those. The Moore affidavit, which we put in, which went in unrebutted, and is at, I believe, B46 through 49 of our appendix, explains the fact that Maryland has an all-encompassing regulatory policy with regard to public utilities, especially electric utilities, that choose to act within their borders. And Delmarva is separately regulated by the state of Maryland. And in fact, I had the Maryland Code. There's actually a separate whole law that's enacted in the Maryland Code with regard to behavior of utilities within its border. In this kind of a situation, if this court were to simply now try to enact it, it's almost an invitation to individuals from any of the states that don't have particular types of law that lawyers may not like, such as pure contributory negligence versus comparative negligence, to come to Delaware if entities are incorporated here in Delaware, or they can somehow obtain jurisdiction over them. But this court has said in the Lake opinion that no, this court is going to look at all the factors with regard to that in each individual case and analyze them as the lower court did in this case and look at the interests in the particular actions. And we're not talking here, and under the principle of decoupage, this court can look at different issues separately. We're not talking about really Delmarva's conduct. We're talking about the conduct of the Maryland resident performing the contract in Maryland as a licensed individual within the state of Maryland and how that relates. That is the significant, most significant conduct, I think, in terms of what we're dealing with in this particular set of facts. I'm not sure if I've answered Your Honor's question. I want to make sure that if you have any follow-ups, that I can answer them.
That's fine. Thank you.
Well, actually, I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think I understand your position, but you've never really commented on the fact that contributory negligence is a very limited principle in its applicability around the entire country at this point, and that, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, Maryland does not have a statute, so it doesn't have a statement by the General Assembly that says we've decided that contributory negligence is the way these matters should be resolved. It's historical. And throughout the country, almost every other jurisdiction has determined that there's not an appropriate place for that particular legal principle anymore. Isn't that a pretty strong policy that militates against applying Maryland's law on this?
Your Honor, in the Harrison decision and in some of its predecessors that are cited within the Harrison decision, Maryland's highest court indicated that if this doctrine were to be changed from the Maryland common law, which had long been in effect, that it should be done by the legislature. The legislature had, as happened actually in this jurisdiction, if we go back, and I don't have the specific cites, this court, I think on more than one occasion prior to the adoption of Delaware's comparative negligence statute, indicated that it could not take action and that the legislature should be the entity that takes a look at this. They've chosen not to do that. Excuse me, Your Honor.
That's exactly my point, is that we're not dealing with an express statement of policy by the legislature of Maryland. We're dealing with an historical evolution of common law that it's been sitting there for, you know, couple of hundred years, and the Maryland court says, well, this is the way our law has evolved, and the General Assembly hasn't stepped in and changed it, so this is the way it's going to stay. Isn't that less of a statement of the policy of Maryland than if there were a statute in Maryland that expressed the policy as opposed to simply a stare decisis, well, this is what the law was a few hundred years ago, and nobody has told us to change it?
Your Honor, I think if the court were to consider the Harrison decision and some of its predecessor decisions where there was calls by the Maryland court for action to happen if it were to happen by the legislature, the fact that the legislature chose not to act is a factor that this court can consider of equal power. The legislative process, as Your Honor is well aware from the many statutes you've reviewed and taken and analyzed the terms, is a different track in the sense that the fact that there wasn't an express statutory rejection of any kind of comparative negligence law, I think, doesn't have to happen. I think the fact that there was a call that if this issue was to be addressed, it should be addressed by the legislature, but wasn't for now 26 years since Harrison was handed down, I think is a factor that, that this court can consider as a policy from the state of Maryland.
Okay, and what about the fact that pretty much every other jurisdiction considers the policy to be one of comparative negligence of one form or another? Isn't that a significant factor for this court to consider in terms of what the competing which of the competing policies should be enforced here?
I think where there has been a clear action by the state where the accident took place, where the people are residents, and where the key factors are, I don't think it should be that type of ruling. I think it should be left to Maryland to make that decision. We could go through piecemeal any number of different types of doctrines that this court could look at from other states. I think the court is opening a huge nest here.
What I'm suggesting is that arguably Maryland is an outlier. If only 4 out of 50 jurisdictions follow a rule of contributory negligence at this point, and that arguably that should have some bearing on our analysis of what policy should prevail here, because it's not just, well, some jurisdictions go one way, some go another, and this accident took place in Maryland, we'll go with whatever they use. It's pretty much everyone goes one way and Maryland goes the other.
If I can give a parallel, Your Honor, Klein versus Prowler Industries, where Delaware was one of, I think, 6 states that has not adopted strict liability in tort, Delaware took its position despite that. And in this particular case, as an oddity, plaintiffs are arguing that Delaware law should not apply as to Mr. Longarm, only as to Delmarva. They don't recognize Delaware doesn't recognize strict liability in tort. Maryland does. I've run out of time, and I'm happy to address any additional issues.
Good morning, Mr. Edwards.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. Philip Edwards on behalf of the defendant, Longarm. I will just be addressing the contributory negligence issue and the strict liability issue, since plaintiffs have conceded that Maryland law shall apply to all the claims against Longarm in this matter, because the contacts are far less than the EPNL, and there really is no argument as to the application of Delaware law in this case to Mr. Longarm. Therefore, I'm going to start with the doctrine of pure contributory negligence, which has been touched on by the Court, which needs no explanation. It's basically a bar to plaintiff's claim. If the plaintiff is even 1% negligent or 1/100th of 1% negligent, it's a bar to their claim. And that's what the application must be to Mr. Longarm here, since Maryland law shall apply. Based on the lower court's decision, where the lower court correctly stated and clearly laid out the long history of cases defeating electrocution cases in Maryland based on contributory negligence, the Frazee case precluded recovery where a painter put his metal ladder against a wire. The court said, when there's a wire there that's readily, you have an obligation to see it, to heed, to protect yourself against it, and if you don't do that, you're contributory negligent as a matter of law, and therefore the court granted summary judgment. In Campbell, the Maryland Supreme Court affirmed precluding a claim for an aluminum solder whose equipment made contact with the wire. Blanchard, an antenna, someone was walking with a big TV antenna like this and mistakenly hit a wire. And these cases have been the court has held up summary judgment, even where the plaintiff, not like in this instance where we don't have the opportunity to talk to the plaintiff about what he did or didn't see. That case, the plaintiff came in and said, I didn't see the wire. And the court said, we will still uphold the summary judgment because it's not a subjective analysis. It's an objective analysis. And the fact that you're saying you didn't see the wire doesn't matter. It's what the ordinary reasonable person should have seen. And the court in that case said, you should have seen what's readily apparent to you. Therefore, summary judgment will be upheld. In the bond case, plaintiff must be take reasonable care in observing his surroundings and follow the law, granting summary judgment. Therefore, under the analysis, and I don't mean to make assumptions on what the court wants to do here, but Mr. Price's whole time was used on the choice of law issue. And I'm inferring from that the contrib law is very bad for the plaintiff in this instance, so that's where the court was focusing most of its attention. Therefore,
We used the time for oral argument for a lot of different reasons, but certainly everything that's been briefed is before us and will be considered. So we haven't narrowed the issues in any way.
Yes, Your Honor. And now I must turn to the strict liability issue, which is unique to my clients. Here, the lower court, our position is correctly granted summary judgment based on Mr. Yoder's misuse of the product and failure to adhere to the clear, conspicuous warning. Just to address plaintiffs, when plaintiffs stood up, when plaintiff was arguing, they asserted that the Ellsworth case was the main case they were relying on to defeat summary judgment in this matter. And I must respectfully disagree with my counsel on the plaintiff's side with regard to the holding in Ellsworth. Now, plaintiff stated that Ellsworth also had a warning in the case. But in that matter, I will quote directly from the case, Cone Mills was the manufacturer of the nightgown in question. It was then given to a distributor named Schern. Schern, the warning went to the retailer. In that case, the retailer never passed on the warning to the ultimate users of the product. Therefore, in that case, the Ellsworth case, there was no warning to the user of the product. Here there is. Here there's a clear, conspicuous warning saying don't go within 10 feet of a power line.
Wait a second. How conspicuous was it?
Very. In yellow, bold print on a pole, Your Honor, taking up, I don't know the exact dimensions of it, but it's in red writing. There's lightning bolts. It's yellow. There's red writing on it. It says danger and not to get within 10 feet of a power line. Now, the argument against to say why it's unclear because it doesn't say that electrocution will follow. But if you look at the cases where strict liability, where misuse and failure to adhere to warnings apply, was applied by the court in granting summary judgment in Simpson, it was a gasoline case, and said, warning, do not store, keep away from children, do not keep in living quarters. It does not say, do not keep away from children because they will get burned. Do not keep in living quarters because it may blow up. Therefore, the court still held those warnings as sufficient. Plaintiff's argument in that regard, it's just not compatible with the law of the jurisdiction of the law of Maryland.
Well, I thought there's also an argument there's a human factors engineer.
Yes, Your Honor.
And why doesn't that create an issue?
Because, as the lower court correctly noted, the Maryland statute applying to plaintiff in this case says that once you see any wire, you have an obligation to contact the Maryland, the DP&L, or any power company and have them come out and check the wire because they're assumed to think any wire has 750 volts or higher. There is a nest of wires. If Your Honor would focus in his analysis on the pictures at B89 through 91, where it shows the clear nest of wires, and that's not my language, that's the language of the lower court. The Maryland courts have clearly said when something's readily apparent, you have to take heed, the ordinary reasonable person will be shown to have seen it and to take heed from it. Here there's an unmistakable nest of wires very, very close to where Mr. Yoder was working. Therefore, what the human factors expert was talking about was the actual wire that he hit. He does not talk about the rest of the wires that were there that Mr. Yoder, by statute, had to have seen. Therefore, the human factors expert really has no bearing on this analysis because the human factors expert can't, in good conscience, talk about Mr. Yoder not seeing the nest of wires. He's just talking about the one actual wire that was the highest that he actually hit. Mr. Yoder's duty was triggered once he saw all the wires. Mr. Yoder can't make his own analysis and say, all right, I see 10 wires running across here. I may not see one of them. I think two of them may be energized and three maybe not, so I don't have an obligation to call the power company. In that instance, once he sees one wire, he has an obligation to follow the statute, call the power company, and have the wire insulated. Again, there's a long line of cases in Maryland granting summary judgment on strict liability claims. The Hoon case, the Halliday case, the Moran case, and the Stancil case. The Stancil case also says, if I may just finish with the Stancil case, says, Your Honor.
Well, unfortunately, you're out of time, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you very much.
Briefly, following up regarding the warning that Mr. Longarm was just speaking about, the warning is found at A241, and you'll be able to see the very small print regarding the warning versus all of the other information that Mr. Longarm chose to put on that. And that warning according to Mr. Longarm, had not changed even though they were made aware of at least five electrocutions since that or a similar warning were on their poles, and it remained there at the time of Mr. Yoder's electrocution. The issue that Mr. Price brought up about the choice of law, there may be some confusion as to what elements are being questioned in the case. The restatement talks about a number of sections that deal with different aspects of a claim. They deal with, for instance, what is negligent conduct? What is the duty of one person to another? What is the standard of conduct? None of those, Your Honor, is the plaintiff suggesting under the choice of law issues before the court would be decided by Delaware law. Certainly a jurisdiction, there would be a heavy preference for a jurisdiction to use its own law for the conduct that occurs in its jurisdiction and whether or not that conduct may be negligent or not. But contributory negligence does not address what negligent conduct is. It denies one damages. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.